From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we begin the Beguine and celebrate the 100th anniversary of Cole Porter's birth with a concert of his songs performed by Barbara Lee. Also, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch, Ken Roth, tells us about his recent trip to Kuwait, where he observed the trials of men and women accused of collaborating with the Iraqis. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Spike Lee's new movie, Jungle Fever. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Federal Aviation Administration officials say that two civilian-registered military-type antique planes collided in midair late this afternoon over Lafayette, Georgia. One plane was a T-37, which crashed. The other plane is an A-27, which landed in Cartersville, Georgia. Kathleen Bergen, FAA spokeswoman in Atlanta, described the incident.
The A-26 has landed in Cartersville, Georgia, which is where both aircraft were based. Our people have spoken to the pilot, who has reported that the A-26 hit the tail of the T-37, shearing that tail off and making the T-37 unable to fly.
There's no word of any injuries or fatalities. The government says the nation's unemployment rate jumped to 6.9% in May. Another 370,000 Americans were added to the jobless rolls. The Labor Department says the rise in civilian unemployment was a sharp 0.3%, up from April's 6.6% rate. Unemployment has been steadily going up since the recession began last July, except for a one-month let-up in April. Most analysts say April's numbers were just a fluke. The bodies of two University of Florida students have been found in Gainesville, Florida today, in the same part of town where five college students were discovered murdered last summer. Lisa Barr of member station WUFT in Gainesville reports.
Alachua County Sheriff's detectives are stressing that they don't consider this linked with any other murders, an obvious reference to the five murders which occurred last summer in the same suburban area of Gainesville. Police have not filed charges in the earlier slayings. The two women were found this morning by a male friend. Alachua County Sheriff's Detective Andy Hamilton would only say the case is a possible homicide and that the two women appeared to be in their early 20s. He would answer no questions. For National Public Radio, I'm Lisa Barr in Gainesville.
Secretary of State James Baker and Soviet Foreign Minister Alexander Besmertnik have left Geneva after holding talks on arms control. There are still some items to be worked out in a proposed nuclear arms reduction agreement before an American-Soviet summit can be held. The two diplomats met for nearly 3 hours today and reportedly traded several new ideas on disarmament. But Baker later said there's still a great deal of work that needs to be done before talks can conclude. A top aide to Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir is countering reports that Israel has turned down President Bush's request for concessions on the Middle East peace process. Sources in Washington say that Mr. Shamir sent Mr. Bush a long letter in which he refused to compromise on procedural issues in proposed Arab-Israeli talks. But the Prime Minister's media advisor denied that Shamir had rejected the president's appeal. On Wall Street, the Dow fell 18 points today to close at 2976.74. Trading was active. This is NPR News. A federal judge has upheld a ban on cameras at executions in California and denied a public television station the right to film a prisoner being put to death. U.S. District Judge Robert Schnacke overturned the San Quentin State Penitentiary's prohibition on all reporters at executions, but he said the ban on cameras, still cameras, and television cameras is justified by security reasons. Risks cited are the chance of a prison riot, the risk to security guards whose identities could be revealed, and the possibility that heavy camera equipment could crash into the shield outside of the gas chamber. Public station KQED wants to film the execution of convicted killer Robert Alton Harris as part of a documentary it's making on him. The White House said today it's received a letter from the President of China indicating that Beijing will attend a five-nation conference on limiting arms sales to the Middle East. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The conference was proposed by President Bush as part of his initiative to limit weapons sales in the region in the aftermath of the Persian Gulf War. The French government has agreed to host the discussions. The White House today called China's decision to attend the talks a positive step that will strengthen international non-proliferation efforts. The Chinese are believed to have sold missiles to several Middle Eastern nations, including Syria. China's willingness to attend the talks does them no harm at a time when the administration and Congress are discussing whether to continue granting China most favorable nation trading status. The White House is still awaiting a reply from Moscow to the invitation, but the Soviets are expected to attend. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Romanian President Ion Iliescu says legislative elections won't be held before spring of next year. That statement contradicts one by the finance minister who said 3 days ago that elections could be held as early as this fall. Pope John Paul condemned Western lifestyles today, telling Polish people not to give in to lustful urges or become slaves to their possessions. The Pope is wrapping up a 9-day tour of his homeland. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cole Porter was born 100 years ago, and today we celebrate with a concert of his songs. Sunday, June 9th, marks the centenary of his birth. It's remarkable how many of Porter's songs have become pop and jazz standards. Just his songs starting with the letter I include I Concentrate on You, I Get a Kick Out of You, I Love Paris, In the Still of the Night, It's All Right with Me, It's the Lovely, and I've Got You Under My Skin. What makes Porter even more remarkable is he wrote both lyrics and music. My guest is Barbara Lee, a singer that John S. Wilson of the New York Times has described as one of the most knowledgeable interpreters and collectors of popular songs. She made her first record in the mid-50s and now records for Audiophile. Lee lives in New York, where she's an important part of the cabaret scene. At the piano today is Tony Tamborello, who has often accompanied Tony Bennett in performance and has been Frank Sinatra's rehearsal pianist. Here's Barbara Lee.
This song is from Jubilee, the show which gave us Begin the Beguine and Just One of Those Things. And it concerned, I think, a native princess on a South Sea island dreaming of Hollywood and the States and romance and so on. Very lovely ballad. All my life I've been so secluded. Love has eluded me. But from knowing secondhand what I'd do of it, I feel certain I could stand a closer view of it. Till today I've studied love discreetly, but now that I'm completely free, I must find some kind persona grata to give me data personally. When romance passes by, why shouldn't I know of love? Why wait around when each age has a sage who has earth, love is all that is really worth thinking of. It must be fun, lots of fun, to be sure when day is done that the hour is coming. Be kissed again. All debutantes say it's good, and every star out in far Hollywood seems to give it a try. So why shouldn't I?
That's beautiful. Well, we're here to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the birth of Cole Porter. Tell me, if you could, what makes Cole Porter singular to you, why you love his songs, what makes him different from other composers?
Gosh, you know, each great composer has his own particular way of writing. Cole Porter had a wonderful musical ear as well as wonderful musical training. And one thing that he did was vary the melody slightly in each eight bars. He'd go da-da in one and then da-da and then da-da, and he would do little variations, so it wasn't just the straight repetition. And they were very rich musically. The lyrics, of course, he was incomparably romantic. I really don't think any other lyric writer was as unabashedly passionate as Cole Porter. And at the same time, he had, of course, the marvelous cleverness, the great knowledge to write those laundry list songs of his and so on. And yet they weren't simply laundry lists. The way he shifted the interior rhymes around. People think rhymes are just rhymes. Not at all. Rhymes have everything to do with the rhythm of a song, the line length and so on. They just have everything to do with the variety of a song. It almost doesn't matter what the rhyme is so much as where it's placed. And of course, if he sets something up, which he often does, he'll set it up so that you're expecting a certain rhyme, and he'll give you something else. He just had everything going for him.
Tony, do you want to add something from your perspective as a musician about Cole Porter?
Well, his harmonies are so sophisticated, they're a joy to play. It's always something fresh coming up in a chord. I must tell you, Jerry, you know, this celebration with the anniversary, I'm working in town in a restaurant, and the Italian waiter comes up to me and says, Tony, would you mind playing some Cold Water? It took me a minute to figure it out.
Is that how well he knew Cole Porter stuff?
No, but it was a request from some of the customers. They wanted to hear some Cole Porter, and he thought it was Cold Water.
Well, not everybody knows Cole Porter.
How about another song?
Oh, all right. This song is from a rather early Cole Porter show. I'm ashamed to say I can't remember the name of the show, but he wrote it, I believe, in the 20s while he was living in Paris and studying composition with Nadia Boulanger. And the verse particularly just shows the astonishing things that he was able to do, whether because of the influence of this legendary composer trainer or not, I don't know. But of course, it has that wonderful Cole Porter naughtiness. Since first you crossed my horizon with your load of love charms, I spend my whole time devising means to stay in your arms. There must be some tricky treatment that would cool my brain, for to me it's so plain, and you'll admit the fact that I'm practically sane. You're a bad influence on me. Sorry, but you're a bad influence, I must say. For I get in such a dither when you use your famous come hither, that all thought of hame and mither seems to wither away. The thing your eyes do to me is such folly that I feel sure your middle name must be Svengali. You throw me right off of my stride. Still, I beg of you, stay by my side and be a bad influence on me. Thank you. start shooting, 'cause I'm sure you used to say black mass with Rasputin. I wish you'd cease singeing my wings, but before you do, take off your things and be a bad influence on me.
That was great. It's a wonderful lyric. It must be really nice to sing songs that you can sing with conviction, because the lyric's so well written, you don't have to be embarrassed by any lines.
Yes. Sometimes you get a request for a song that isn't well written, and then it's really a test. It's really a challenge to think, what am I going to do? This is such a nice person. I want to do this song for this person. What can I do to it to make this lyric come alive? And what can I do to get over these embarrassing places? Often you find you just have to go counter to the intent of a song. Sometimes it'll be so ridiculously romantic that you have to take it very casually, or sometimes it's a kind of casual, hard-boiled song that you have to bring romance to.
Can you think of an example?
No. At this moment.
Okay.
No.
Barbara Lee, I want to find out a little bit about you.
Oh, all right.
Now, you started recording back in 1955.
Yes.
What were you like then? How was your voice different? What were you singing?
My voice was very much the same, except that for the last 5 years or so, I've been solvent, so I've been able to take voice lessons.
You're taking voice lessons now?
Now. I've just started, and it's wonderful, and it hasn't changed my voice at all, except it's easier. Everything flows more easily now. It's opened up the range. I've got a little more range on top and a little more on the bottom. Basically, I've had the same range since I was a tiny child. You know, people would say, you're Barbara Leacock. I haven't seen you since you were 4 years old. I'd know you anywhere by your voice.
Barbara Leacock, huh?
That was me.
That was your real name?
Yes, from Detroit.
And you changed it to Barbara Lee to perform?
Yes.
Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more, and we'll hear some more songs by Cole Porter. And we're celebrating Cole Porter's centenary, the 100th anniversary of his birth. And singing is Barbara Lee, at the piano is Tony Tamburello. And we're after this short break. This is Fresh Air. We're celebrating the 100th anniversary of Cole Porter's birth with singer Barbara Lee, pianist Tony Tamburello. And I should mention here that Barbara Lee has a couple of recent albums called Sweet and Slow and You're the Cats, and they're both on the Audiophile record label. When we asked you to do the concert, we asked you to do some songs that we'd all know and a couple of songs that would be discoveries for us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the song you're about to do is something that's going to be a discovery for us.
Yes, I hope so. I've never heard anyone else do it. I just found a piece of sheet music in Lincoln Center Library. It was sung by the mother of the debutante in, I think, the New Yorkers. Not the New Yorkers. Oh, goodness, I'm going to goof everything. Paris? 50 Million Frenchmen. That's it. He wrote so many Paris shows and so many New York shows, I get them mixed up. 50 Million Frenchmen. What is that, my note?
You like that one?
Give me a chord, don't give me a note. My mother and father once went to a lot of bother to make me the happiest of girls. To further my station, they gave me an education, not to mention a string of pearls. But in spite of my backing, I still feel there's something lacking, and that fate has rather let me down. For instead of being famous, I'm an unknown ignoramus from a small Middle Western town. Why couldn't I have been Salome, or Mary Pickford, or Joan of Arc? If I were Eleanor Glynn, or even Anne Boleyn, the future wouldn't look half so dark. Why couldn't I be Whistler's mother, or any other woman of note? Why did the gods decree that I should only be the Queen of Terra Haute?
That's great. So you found that on sheet music.
Yes.
And you've never heard it performed.
No. Mm-mm.
You think it's recorded anywhere?
I don't know. Huh. I don't know. I know it's from the 20s. I can just see Mary Boland or somebody kind of wandering out onto a stage disconsolately. For some reason, I see her with a suitcase in her hand.
So this is the kind of thing you do a lot, just go searching for sheet music of obscure songs.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's my favorite pastime.
And we'll contrast that with a very well-known song that you're about to sing for us.
When they begin the begin, it brings back the sound of music so tender. It brings back a night of tropical splendor. It brings back a memory evergreen. I'm with you once more under the stars, and down by the shore an orchestra's playing, and even the palms seem to be swaying. When they begin the begin, to live it again is past all endeavor. Except when that tune clutches my heart, and there we are swearing to love forever, and promising never, never to part. What moments divine, what rapture serene, till clouds came along to disperse the joys we had tasted. And now when I hear people curse the chance that was wasted, I know but too well what they mean. So don't let them begin the begin. Let the love that was once a fire remain an ember. Let it sleep like the dead desire I only remember. When they begin the begin. Oh, yes, let them begin the begin. Make them play till the stars that were there before what heaven we're in when they begin. The beginning.
That's beautiful. I think that's the saddest and most felt version of that I've ever heard. It's usually much more kind of up-tempo and
yes.
danceable. And
yeah.
Tell me about thinking through the song and deciding how to do it that way.
Well, all I can tell you is that you have to know the story before you can tell the story. People are so interested in selling their sadness or selling their joy or whatever it is, but they don't ever bother to feel that. And I just, you know, I was an actress for many years, and I know what that song's about from my life. If I didn't know what it was about from my life, I'd know what it was about from my imagination. And I tell the story. That's all. And I love it. I love that. I think it's possibly the greatest song ever written. I know it's never been done this way. And I know if they try, they won't be able. So this song is mine. New York, New York is Liza Minnelli's. This one is mine.
Well, I want to thank you so much for helping us celebrate the 100th anniversary of the birth of Cole Porter. And the actual date of that centenary is the 9th, Sunday. And it's really been a pleasure to hear you sing, Barbara Lee. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure for me.
And I want to mention, if you want to hear more of Barbara Lee, she has a couple of CDs, recent CDs called Sweet and Low and You're the Cats on the Audiophile record label. And Tony Tamborello, thank you very, very much for coming.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed your playing very much. And thank you.
Thank you.
Tony, would you play us out?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's been about 3 months since Kuwait was liberated from Iraq. Now Kuwait is faced with internal human rights violations. Ken Roth, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch, just returned from Kuwait, where he observed the trials of people accused of collaborating with the Iraqis. And he investigated allegations that Kuwaiti security forces have been using violence and torture. Coming up, Roth reports on his findings. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Jungle Fever, Spike Lee's new movie about an interracial couple. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Secretary of State James Baker met today with the Soviet foreign minister in Geneva, and both sides are said to have put forth new proposals in an effort to break a deadlock on an arms limitation agreement. Both President Bush and Soviet leader Gorbachev had said that they wanted a START treaty ready for signing by the end of last year. But as Christopher Powell reports from Geneva for the BBC, there are still problems.
START stands for Strategic Nuclear Arms Reduction Talks, and the reduction part at least has been achieved. Both sides have agreed to limits of 6,000 nuclear warheads and 1,600 launches each, but there's still no mutually acceptable way of checking that neither side is cheating. The draft treaty says the number of nuclear-tipped missiles allowed on each launcher should be limited to 10, but the negotiators can't agree on how to make sure that the other side simply doesn't cheat and put the warheads back later. It's clear that in 2 hours, Mr. Baker and Mr. Besmertnik won't be able to solve problems which have eluded arms control experts for nearly a decade. And despite the Secretary of State's confidence that these issues won't be held over until future negotiations, it's difficult to see how, without such a compromise, a treaty can be ready for signing in time for the planned summit.
Christopher Powell reporting for the BBC. Officials say that two antique military airplanes collided in the air over northwest Georgia this afternoon near Chattanooga, Tennessee. One plane crashed and exploded. The FAA says that rescuers located the wreckage of the T-37 but found no bodies. The other airplane, said to be an A-26, sustained nose damage but was able to land at Cartersville, Georgia. Bridgeport, Connecticut, the seat of one of the nation's wealthiest counties, has taken a dramatic step to deal with its budget deficit, a step that state officials say is not legal. Jerry DeOrio of member station WSHU reports.
Bridgeport, Connecticut's largest city, filed for federal bankruptcy protection yesterday. Mayor Mary C. Moran gave the first word of the city's action at an emergency meeting of the Common Council last night. The city's decision to file a Chapter 9 petition comes after weeks of futile attempts to close a $12 million budget gap without cutting police services or drastically raising property taxes. The city's Financial Review Board, which barred Moran from pursuing bankruptcy proceedings earlier this year, met this afternoon and passed a resolution forbidding the city to file for protection. Bill Sibas, the governor's top financial advisor, and State Attorney General Richard Blumenthal said the city had no authority to file under Chapter 9 of the Federal Bankruptcy Code and that the state would be filing motions to have the city's bankruptcy petition dismissed. For National Public Radio, I'm Jerry DeOrio.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down almost 18 points to close at 2,976.74, volume 168 million shares. This is NPR News. In the face of a possible presidential veto, the House has approved a $295 billion military spending bill by a vote of 273-105. Officials have said that President Bush would veto the measure because of cuts in his so-called Star Wars plan and the B-2 bomber, along with more money for conventional weapons. The bill includes the Bush administration's proposal to cut active-duty troop strength by some 106,000, but includes $300 million to ensure that the Army does not lay off soldiers. The Labor Department says that the nation's unemployment rate jumped sharply in May to 6.9%, adding another 370,000 people to the jobless figure. At the same time, the government says that U.S. companies added nearly 60,000 new jobs. NPR's John Itzty reports.
The apparent contradiction of a rise in the unemployment rate, at the same time American companies are adding tens of thousands of new jobs, occurs because the two statistics come from two separate surveys. The numbers on new jobs come from the Payroll Survey, a monthly survey of U.S. employers, which is viewed as a relatively accurate indication of job growth or decline. The unemployment rate, which went from 6.6% to 6.9% in May, is based on an entirely different survey of American households. That survey is more volatile than the payroll survey. In fact, in April, the unemployment rate dropped unexpectedly. Then, as we found out today, in May, it rose sharply. I'm John Itzty in Washington.
Soviet Prime Minister Pavlov has accused the West of putting up a credit blockade against Moscow. Earlier this year, the Prime Minister stirred up controversy by accusing Western banks of plotting the overthrow of Soviet leader Gorbachev. Gorbachev is expected to meet leaders of the 7 leading industrialized nations next month. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We've all heard about the man in Kuwait who was sentenced to 15 years for wearing a Saddam Hussein T-shirt. Is that typical of the post-war trials in Kuwait? Ken Roth, deputy director of Human Rights Watch, returned this week from a 9-day trip to Kuwait. He observed the trials of men and women accused of collaborating with the Iraqis. He investigated charges that Kuwaiti security forces are using violence and torture against non-citizens. And he looked into the situation of refugees and displaced persons. On Tuesday, he'll testify before Congress. We invited him to share his findings with us, starting with the trials.
Well, what has been surprising is that there have been no really big fish to emerge out of the collaborator trials so far. This is nothing like the Nuremberg trials, for example, where mass murderers or torturers are being put on trial. In part, that probably is due to the fact that many of those responsible for the most serious abuses were Iraqis who simply fled back to Iraq during the ground war and were able to escape Kuwaiti jurisdiction. Those people who are being tried range from, on the one hand, people who are being accused of informing to the Iraqi authorities, a very serious charge since informing often could lead to torture and death for those informed upon. They also, in perhaps the most interesting case so far, include people who are accused of helping write and run a newspaper, Al Nida, put out by the occupation authorities during several months of the occupation.
Now, there have been, I believe, 22 people accused of collaborating with this newspaper of the Iraqi occupation. What are some of the issues that this trial raises in terms of how due process is being handled in the Kuwaiti trials?
Well, the Al Nida trial is significant because it is the first trial in which detailed evidence has actually been presented. A number of the trials after the first day, which was ridiculous by its summary nature. But after that initial day, the courts have been quite careful to appoint attorneys and then adjourn the trial so that the attorneys could prepare before later evidence was introduced. The Al Nida trial was the first to get to the second stage in which evidence was actually presented. And the nature of that evidence was quite troubling in my view. The lead defendant, the only Kuwaiti on trial, a Kuwaiti woman, had quite a bit of direct testimony presented against her. But for the other 21 of the 22 defendants on trial, the main issue that they were raising, the main defense, was one of coercion. They would say, look, we were forced to participate on Al Nida by the occupation authorities, and we risked torture or death at Iraqi hands. We had no choice. And the only evidence that the Kuwaiti prosecutor has presented to rebut that defense of coercion has been evidence presented through a police officer that supposedly was reported to him by an unidentified secret source. And despite defense efforts to learn the attributes of the secret force or to identify him, the police officer simply refused even to say whether the source had been in Kuwait throughout the occupation, whether he or she had worked for the newspaper for the entire period. It led me to wonder whether there even was a secret source or whether this so-called source was simply an agglomeration of various pieces of evidence of questionable reliability that the prosecutor had been able to piece together.
Is the verdict in yet for these 22 who are accused of collaborating?
No. The summations have been made, and so it appears that all that is left is for the five-judge panel to render its decision, and that decision is now awaited on June 15th.
Now, I believe some people who have been arrested and are facing charges are saying that they were forced under pressure or through torture to confess to crimes or to collaboration with the Iraqis. What can you tell us about that?
Well, many of the defendants, not only in the Al Nida trial, but in a number of the other collaborator trials as well, have attempted to repudiate confessions that were secured by Kuwaiti police officers through beatings and torture. And fortunately, a number of the defendants have felt free enough to complain to the judicial tribunal about this torture and thus to attempt to disown the confession. It's not entirely clear to what extent the judges will accept their statements or will rely on the confessions that were secured by police authorities. I, outside of the trials, was able to speak with a number of Palestinians and others who had been arrested by the police and who had suffered very much the same sort of torture that the defendants on trial are complaining of. For example, I interviewed three Palestinian and one Iraqi youths who, in mid-May, were arrested at a checkpoint, and checkpoints are rather pervasive at this stage in Kuwait. They were brought to a local police station, the Sabah al-Salam police station, and put through an ordeal that appeared to have become entirely routinized in that the police officers present actually had names for each of the different torture chambers. There was a party room, a barbecue room, a drinking juice room, and in each room the victims were forced to submit to tortures appropriate to that room, ranging from beatings with sticks and clubs to electric shock therapy and having cigarettes put out on their skin, to in the drinking juice room being forced to drink what seemed to them to be sewage water. Throughout all of this, the police officers would yell questions at them that were vaguely designed to elicit possible collaboration under the occupation, but in fact seemed more designed simply to badger them. They would be asked, how many Kuwaiti girls did you rape? How many Kuwaiti officers did you turn into the Iraqis? How many cars did you steal? What were you doing during the occupation? Without any real effort to get answers to these questions, but more as an excuse to have some fun, if one views this as fun, with these unfortunate Palestinians. And I saw them roughly 10 days after they had endured this torture, and they still bore obvious scars from this ordeal.
And you spoke to enough Palestinians who gave you very similar stories for you to feel that you could accept that as corroboration that these stories were true.
Yeah. Unfortunately, this experience is one that is quite common, particularly in the Palestinian community. And in fact, it is so pervasive at this stage that it led me to wonder whether it wasn't part of a design on the part of the Kuwaiti government to seek to gradually encourage those Palestinians who remain in Kuwait to simply leave. Roughly half of the Palestinian community that was there before August 2nd fled in the course of the occupation, and those people are simply not being permitted back into Kuwait at this time. Those who remain are at this stage unemployed. The government has systematically fired them, and many of them are terrified to leave their home for fear of encountering the sort of violence that these four youths met in the police station. The only thing at this stage that keeps many of these Palestinians from simply leaving Kuwait right now is that the Kuwaiti government has not released their pensions, the 1 month's salary per year that they accumulate as they work, and which is really a nest egg for retirement or for some future life in another country. And if they were able to receive that, as well as to obtain permission to travel by land through Saudi Arabia to Jordan so that they could bring their furnishings and belongings with them, it's quite clear that a substantial percentage of the Palestinian community that remains in Kuwait would flee quite quickly, despite the fact that they were all very happy in Kuwait earlier and had quite a decent life until the Iraqi occupation.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Roth. He's deputy director of Human Rights Watch, and he just returned to the United States Tuesday after spending 9 days in Kuwait. He'll testify before Congress this Tuesday. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Ken Roth is my guest, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch, and we're talking about his recent trip to Kuwait. A lot of people speculated that when the war was over, Kuwaiti citizens would try to push out people who were residents of Kuwait but not citizens of the country, because so many of those residents who aren't citizens, people known as Bedouins, had been accused of collaborating with the Iraqis. Do you see other evidence of that, of Kuwaitis trying to push out people who they are now suspicious of?
The Kuwaiti government has quite openly talked about the need to restructure their population. And these efforts have been aimed principally at Arab non-Kuwaitis. There are many Filipinos and Sri Lankans who are gradually being welcomed back, but they're not perceived as the same sort of threat as the Palestinian, the Iraqi, and the so-called Bedouin community within Kuwait, all of whom are accused, in many instances falsely, of having cooperated with the Iraqi authorities. The Bedouins are an interesting problem because whereas many of the Palestinians have Jordanian nationality and at least have another place to go, and obviously many of the long-term Iraqi residents of Kuwait could reluctantly return to Iraq if need be, the Bedouin are stateless people. The word Bedouin in Arabic means without nationality. And these are, for the most part, of Bedouin origin. They were nomads. And in 1959, when it became possible to register as a Kuwaiti citizen, many of these more nomadic residents of Kuwait simply didn't bother. The lines were long. It cost a little bit of money. It wasn't clear what the purpose of being a citizen was in any event. And their descendants today are now stuck in this permanent status of inferiority. Even before the invasion, it had been possible for Bedouin to work only in the police and the military. And in essence, they were used as an underclass to cheaply fill the rank and file of the armed forces in positions where Kuwaitis would not want to serve. Many of them served Kuwait quite loyally. In fact, I heard many stories of Bedouin soldiers who were taken as POWs after having fought the Iraqis and spent the entire occupation period in Iraqi prisons. A number of them lost their lives, and they are quite shocked, those who survived, to return to Kuwait and find not only have they lost their jobs, but in many instances, if their families, for example, happened to have gone to Iraq looking for them, the families are now not being permitted back in, even though the formal POWs have been let back into Kuwait.
Let me get back to the trials that you observed. The case that has gotten the most attention, as far as I know, here in the United States, was the case of the man who was found guilty of wearing a Saddam Hussein T-shirt and sentenced 15 years for the offense. Was that trial atypical or typical of what's happening now?
Well, that trial was atypical in the sense that it was the first set of trials. And on that day, there were 22 defendants who were tried, if you can call it that, in the course of 55 minutes, 2.5 minutes per defendant. That was obviously a joke, and nobody could explain to me adequately why it is that the court went through that that charade. Fortunately, that has not been replicated since then. The Saddam Hussein T-shirt case itself was the subject of a revised opinion that the court issued while I was in Kuwait. A number of Kuwaiti officials have stressed in public statements that in fact, this man was not convicted simply for having worn a T-shirt, but in fact, he was somebody who consorted with the Iraqis, collaborated with them, gave them information and the like. And this revised 3-page single-spaced opinion attempts to set forth the other evidence against this man beyond simply wearing the T-shirt. In fact, when you read it, it's filled with all sorts of generalizations about other kinds of collaboration and informing, but nothing specific. And it goes on at considerable length about the fact that the wearing of this T-shirt demoralized the Kuwaiti population. And I felt reading this thing that what was really going on was precisely what everybody says has been going on, that this man got 15 years for wearing the T-shirt.
Is there a double standard, do you think, in the trials going on now between how Kuwaitis are being dealt with and non-Kuwaiti citizens, how they're being dealt with?
On the one hand, there is a double standard where there shouldn't be, but there's also not a double standard where there should be. Let me explain. There are very few Kuwaiti citizens who are on trial. Most of the people being tried are Iraqis or Palestinians or Bedouin. Now, it may be that it was only these non-Kuwaiti residents of Kuwait who collaborated with the Iraqi authorities, but I somehow doubt that. For example, there was one case in which a man was accused of having repaired an Iraqi jeep that was brought into his car repair facility. The man who was on trial was a non-Kuwaiti national, but the owner of the facility was a Kuwaiti, and he had not been brought to trial. So that suggests a certain double standard that it's too early to say whether it's a pattern, but it's at least disturbing insofar as we've been able to observe. The flip side is that there has not been any obvious sensitivity to what should be a double standard, and that is the different degrees of resistance that Kuwaitis versus non-Kuwaiti nationals or non-Kuwaiti residents of Kuwait should be expected to offer to the occupying authorities. It's important to remember that the Kuwaiti government was in exile at the time, and to insist that a Bedouin or a Palestinian or an Iraqi resist really to the point of possibly risking torture or death when it's not clear that the Kuwaiti government is ever going to be able to come back to Kuwait. And for all these people know, they're stuck living with the Iraqis for the rest of their lives. It's quite unfair to insist that these non-Kuwaiti citizens mount the same sort of resistance as a Kuwaiti citizen who can be expected to have an ongoing duty of loyalty or duty of allegiance to the Kuwaiti government even when it is in exile.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk more with Ken Roth about human rights in post-war Kuwait. Roth is Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. I have a question for you today.
Okay.
Do you know or do you recall what, more or less, the Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's court said when he first caught a glimpse of that magnificent city, Camelot?
I wish I was a New York Yankee.
No, he said, and that would be Bridgeport. That was a long time ago when Mark Twain wrote. Today, instead, Bridgeport's fallen on very hard times and actually is bankrupt. We'll be hearing about the controversy over the mayor of Bridgeport's, it seems, unilateral declaration of bankruptcy and what happened to that Connecticut city.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Spike Lee's new movie, Jungle Fever, just opened. Critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
I can't shake the feeling that Spike Lee is really Madonna in some elaborate disguise. Like Madonna, he's as much self-styled spokesperson as artist. Every few months or so, they both manage to stir up some media-savvy new controversy. And like Madonna, his work gives the illusion of being more complex and coherent than it is, because it does affect you. As Madonna would say, it pushes people's buttons. The buttons in her world are usually sexual taboos. In Spike Lee's world, they're racial taboos. But Jungle Fever manages to combine both. It's about black-white romance, specifically between a cool, buppy architect named Flipper, well played by Wesley Snipes, and his winsome Italian-American secretary, Angela, played very engagingly by Annabella Sciorra. Unfortunately, Lee can't seem to get interested in his two admittedly cardboardy heroes. They no sooner set up housekeeping than he abandons them. What draws him instead is the hell that breaks loose when news of their romance leaks out. In Brooklyn's Bensonhurst neighborhood, Angela gets screamed at, beaten up, disowned. And back in Harlem, Flipper's best friend, played by Spike Lee himself, lets word get back to Flipper's wife, played by the superb Lonette McKee. She promptly kicks her husband out of the house, and when he follows her to Bloomingdale's, where she works, well, the reception he gets is less than gracious.
Look, baby, I know you're upset.
Well, I guess I just wasn't light enough for you, was I, Flipper? You had to eventually go get yourself a white girl, didn't you?
What do you mean, eventually?
What I mean is you got a complex about color. You've always had it. I never wanted to believe it until now. Only girls you've ever dated has been light-skinned girls. You and Cyrus, both of you, both of you. I've told you what happened to me when I was growing up. I've explained to you. I poured my heart out. I told you how they call me high yellow, yellow bitch, white honky, honky white nigga, nigga white, octoroon, quadroon, half-breed, mongrel. And what do? Do you love this girl?
Oh, Drew, you gotta be kidding me.
Do you gotta be kidding me.
I love you.
There's interesting sociological material in that scene, and in fact throughout the movie. Like any good encounter group leader, Spike Lee knows how to open up an issue and let all the contradictions and ramifications pour out. There's a juicy scene in Jungle Fever in which Flipper's wife and her friends have a free-for-all discussion about black men and white women, and it's fabulous stuff. The trouble is none of these women show up as characters during the rest of the film, so the scene feels like the panel discussion it is. Lee can present issues, but he doesn't know how to dramatize them. His characters all tend towards stereotype and caricature. His storylines are muddled, repetitive, and often unbelievable. And when he's not letting his actors improvise, the way he shapes a scene is frequently so stiff and pointed that it feels like one of the canned moments in a musical right before the stars burst into song. The way he uses background music reinforces that impression. Every scene is awash in it, gooey with the stuff. The movie's best material happens way off to the side of things. John Turturro plays Angela's jilted boyfriend, who runs his father's Bensonhurst candy store and turns out to be the movie's only truly open-minded character. He, too, is a bit of a caricature, the sensitive, bookish soul in a world of shrieking racists. But John Turturro's performance is genuinely touching. Back up in Harlem, Flipper has a brother who's a crackhead, and Samuel Jackson simmers in the role. It's the movie's best performance, and it's only truly convincing one. The rest of Jungle Fever plays like a provocative mishmash, and it makes you shake your head. If only Spike Lee hadn't been so lionized at the beginning of his career, maybe he would have had the chance to develop the collaborative skills he so badly needs if he's going to turn into the superb filmmaker he could be instead of the mere agent provocateur that he is.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. The great jazz musician Stan Getz died yesterday at the age of 64. Next Tuesday, we'll remember Getz by rebroadcasting the interview we recorded 1 year ago. Now, some stations may broadcast this interview a day later. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, human rights in post-war Kuwait. We continue our conversation with Ken Roth, Deputy Director of Human Rights Watch. He just returned from Kuwait, where he investigated the situation of refugees and displaced persons. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.